Welcome back to Innovation Hub. I'm Kara Miller. It might seem unbelievable, but 50 years ago, Silicon Valley was largely filled with orchards, not high-tech companies. The real high-tech work was going on in the East, at places like MIT and Harvard and in Murray Hill, New Jersey, where Bell Labs was headquartered, and where a guy named William Shockley shared the Nobel Prize for helping to develop the transistor. So what was the spark that began to transform Silicon Valley into what it is today? I'm joined by Leslie Berlin, a historian at Stanford and author of The Man Behind the Microchip. And also with me is Regis McKenna. He's a legendary Silicon Valley marketer who's worked with companies from Apple to Intel to Microsoft. And they both contribute to American Experience's film Silicon Valley, which premieres in February. Here is a clip from that show.
In June 1957, at San Francisco's luxurious Clift Hotel, eight of the country's most talented young scientists and engineers assembled for a secret meeting. For the previous 14 months, they'd been working together at Shockley Semiconductor Laboratory outside of Palo Alto, developing a technology that promised to be revolutionary. But in recent months, William Shockley, the head of the company, and the mind behind that technology, had become increasingly erratic. Now, the eight were conspiring to defect, to quit Shockley and form their own firm, under the leadership of one of their own, 29-year-old Robert Noyce, a Midwesterner with a brilliant scientific mind and the genuine affability of a born salesman.
Leslie Berlin and Regis McKenna, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
So, Leslie Berlin, what was the spark that started it for Silicon Valley, the thing without which it might not be one of the world's centers of innovation?
Well, I think the spark that really kicked things off might be surprising to some people, because that spark was actually work for the Department of Defense and the federal government. In the earliest days of Silicon Valley, when people started building things like microchips, they were so expensive and they were very, very light that there were only a few places in the world that would be willing to pay the kind of premium you paid for a microchip simply because it was light. And one of the only places, in fact, the place that bought 100% of the original microchips, was the Department of Defense, which used things like missiles and other sorts of space-related technology.
That's interesting. So people sort of think of Silicon Valley as the epitome of entrepreneurship, people who started something from nothing. But in the beginning, it was the government.
Yes, though I would say that those two certainly at that time weren't mutually exclusive. These were small entrepreneurial companies that were building these devices. However, they were being bought by the government. The Department of Defense, I'd say, functioned in a lot the same way that venture capitalists do now in terms of actually providing seed money for these companies to get going. I mean, they needed to have income, and that came from the federal government.
And Regis McKenna, you saw the very beginnings of many companies in Silicon Valley, from Intel to Apple. How did Silicon Valley come to be a place that could lure away some of the smartest PhDs from places like Harvard and MIT and get them to come to what was in the beginning not a really established place in California to do this high-tech research?
Yeah, I should mention that this is my 50th year in technology in Silicon Valley, so I do go back a bit. There was a time in which, you know, the leaders of most of these companies here in the Valley really had moved west, just like the pioneers. It was a new era. There was new technology, new kind of businesses, new opportunities to create your own vision of the future. And I think the lure wasn't any different than sort of the traditional American pioneer, and essentially shake off the hierarchical Eastern institutional business mentalities and strike out on their own.
Did you get the sense from those early people that there was a risk, that they were really nervous about breaking away from the Eastern establishment?
I think they were a unique kind of individuals, but I don't think they were necessarily nervous about it, but I think they were willing to take the risk. They were very young. Most of the people in Shockley's team were under 30. I moved from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. When I was in school, the industry was dying. The steel industry had died. In Pittsburgh, there was really not a lot of future opportunity there. And so the ability to say, when my boss said, would you like to move west, you really didn't have anything to lose. You could try it, and if you didn't, you knew that you could essentially return. So it wasn't as risky as possible, but you knew you were leaving things behind.
Leslie Berlin, you talk about, and your book talks about this guy, Bob Noyce, who in 1968 started a little tiny company called Intel. People may have heard of it. You talk about him as a kind of revolutionary figure and actually somebody who influenced Steve Jobs, influenced the next generation, many of whom became, of course, very famous to us now. How did Bob Noyce revolutionize what was going on in Silicon Valley?
Well, I think Noyce was important on a number of levels. And I'd point out, actually, that he started Intel with Gordon Moore. And one of the ways in which he was very important and influential is that he always worked as parts of a team, particularly by the time he started Intel, which was his second startup, recognized that he needed people around him, that he couldn't carry the entire weight of a company on his own. So he always built a good team. The thing to know about Noyce was he was phenomenally charismatic and incredibly brilliant. And that was quite a potent combination then as it is now. He was able to come up with fantastic ideas, such as, for example, the microchip, and then inspire people to join behind him to build a company around these ideas. And the best example I can give you of what Bob Noyce was like comes from when he was very, very young, 11 years old. He convinced all of the kids on his block in Grinnell, Iowa, that what they really needed to do for the summer was build a boy-sized glider, a glider that one of them could climb in and fly. And he assigned jobs to all of the people on the street. The kid whose dad owned a furniture store provided spindles that the carpets came on. A girl was charged with sewing the cheesecloth. Noyce and his brother completely designed the entire structure from scratch, just having seen pictures in an encyclopedia and flown their own model airplanes. And when the appointed day came, Noyce climbed onto the roof of a barn in a field sort of behind his parents' house, had someone hand him the glider, and climbed inside it and just started running. And when he got to the end of the roof, he just kept on going. And the incredible thing about this is, one, the glider actually stayed airborne for a second before it came to the ground. And two, that he was somehow able to take this really kind of crazy idea of let's build this thing and inspire an entire group of people to do it with him. And that combination of technical finesse and expertise and of compelling vision and of the leadership skills that make people want to join you were this potent combination that lasted throughout his life and career.
That's Robert Noyce that we're talking about, one of the pioneers of Silicon Valley. I'm Kara Miller, and my guests today are Leslie Berlin and Regis McKenna, who are part of an American Experience documentary about the origins of Silicon Valley and the secret sauce in their culture. So, Regis McKenna, what were Robert Noyce's contributions to Silicon Valley and to computer science?
I think there are three things about Bob Noyce that are most significant, and is still his DNA, if you will, the Silicon Valley is being carried through to today. One is the technology. He invented the integrated circuit, but he was also this planar process that started at Fairchild that made them mass producible. And that process made it, you know, their manufacturer. That led to Moore's Law, which Moore's Law says that, you know, these chips have declined in price by 30% every year for the last 40 years. And that means that you can now buy cell phones, you know, very, very inexpensive. They're as powerful as, you know, millions of dollars worth of computing power 20 years ago. He also created a meritocracy of an environment, he and his original founders of Fairchild. And that began this culture of, we don't like where we are, we're going to go off and start something new, and we're going to go outside and find some capital to do it, which really led to the venture capital. That culture still exists today. And then the third thing, I think, is his charismatic personality. He was a marketer. These chips were in search of a technology. The military was too low a volume. So they had to find new markets, and that's why Bob started envisioning devices and chips. He was the first one, back in the 70s, talking about future markets. He talked about how telecommunications was going to become chip-based and information-based. His culture, his whole life ushered in the information age as we know it today.
And now we've got chips and everything. Leslie Berlin from Stanford, let me go back to you and pick up on something that Regis McKenna was talking about. This idea that Bob Noyce, that the first pioneers, so to speak, in Silicon Valley revolutionized the way that workplaces are structured.
Noyce was a big believer that what mattered was what you knew, not where your name happened to appear in an organization chart. And this sort of notion that knowledge is prized over anything meant that anyone could have influence within a company. And this idea led to several things that we associate now with Silicon Valley. One, of course, is the work in the cubicles, which some people may really rue, the lack of executive dining rooms, no assigned parking spaces, this sort of notion that these look different than your sort of establishment companies of the day. Vitally important is the widespread distribution of stock usually via stock options. And this was done, yes, for philosophical purposes and also for practical purposes. Noyce, as well as I would say most of the semiconductor pioneers of his generation, really believed that people would do better work if they had a strong sense of connection and investment in the company, and if they stood really to benefit if their work were taken on by other places and became a hit. And so those are very important ways that this generation moved away from the model that, you know, every job grade has its assigned office space and office furniture to the notion that we reward contribution wherever it comes from.
And I assume the people in the early companies were shocked to see, you know, the CEO or the COO just sitting there in a cubicle like everybody else, or saying, you know, I have stock options, but you should have them too. I'm guessing that really surprised people.
I think, yes, it surprised people coming from elsewhere. But you have to understand that such a high percentage of the people coming into these jobs were themselves fresh out of school. I mean, the only people who knew how to build these things were people who were getting degrees that had only been invented as degrees in, you know, semiconductor engineering just a few years before. So they didn't have necessarily models to fall back on where they felt like, well, this seems very strange. They definitely needed help in understanding what the heck is a stock option. And this is something no one had heard of. And I do think to some of the establishment companies, there was some real head scratching going on. If you go, especially if you go up to the next generation, the generation that sort of built on these microchips, I think Regis could talk to you about the difference between Apple and, say, IBM. Those were some huge differences.
Yeah, Regis, let's talk about what happened with that next generation. And I know you talked to Bill Gates when he was starting out. And actually, I think you told him that his goal should not be to appear on too many magazine covers. He should try to build the business and not focus on the publicity.
Quite frankly, I always told the entrepreneurs that if they focused on building a good company and great innovative products, then they'd get lots of attention. They didn't have to worry about that. But it's a question of the chicken or the egg, which comes first, the publicity or the product, and I think the product comes first. But I think, again, the difference is that the founders and the entrepreneurs of these companies are really marketeers. They go out and meet with customers all the time. They don't sit back and manage a company. Even today, you'll find them constantly. So in a way, Noyce became the first sort of superstar personality, but because of his brilliance and his essentially his credibility as a technologist, he was able to gain great traction with customers, and they loved to meet with him. And he spent much of his time doing that. And that's true of, I think, most of the leaders today. I mean, that was true of whether it was Steve Jobs or Andy Grove or the leaders of Google or Oracle. They are out meeting with customers on a regular basis because they know the technology and they have the highest degrees of credibility to bring the message of the technology to customers.
But do you see people like Mark Zuckerberg, who's head of Facebook, or Sergey Brin and Larry Page, heads of Google, as being a little bit more in a bubble than the Bob Noyes and the Steve Jobs, because really now they're not just stars in the tech world. They're sort of superstars. And I wonder if that limits their mobility.
I don't know that it limits their mobility, but I think that the technology that they work with today, it's software technology, so it's a much more intangible and a complex thing to work with. And, of course, the Internet is so prolific and so diverse. I think their job is much more complex and difficult. You know, 50 years ago or 40 years ago, you really knew what your target customer was going to be. You knew what the products were and evolving. Now, you pushed the edges of the technology in order to expand it. Once sort of the microprocessor came in, it really was the revolution in information age. And it's created these software companies that I think are really struggling to find out, you know, what true north is and where do they move next. They're moving back into hardware. I mean, is Google an ad agency? Is it a search engine? Is it a telephone manufacturer? I don't think we're going to see them become more simplified in the near future.
Regis McKenna is my guest today. I'm Kara Miller, and we're talking about the past and the future of Silicon Valley. And a question for Leslie Berlin from Stanford. I wonder, where is Silicon Valley now? Do you think it is maintaining the innovativeness that it had in the 1960s and 70s?
I would say yes, Silicon Valley is maintaining that. And I would also say that other places have joined what you might think of as the technology supply chain. So we do see other areas of the world that have developed innovation economies of a different sort than Silicon Valley. Maybe they're more focused on actually building the hardware, for example. I would say that what has made Silicon Valley so successful historically has been such a rewarding place to live that people from all over the world have been willing to come here when the first generation of guys came out here. And at that time, in addition to having beautiful weather, we're recording this in January and we're in the mid-60s right now, and proximity to the ocean and to the mountains and to San Francisco. In addition to all of that, property was incredibly cheap. It was cheaper for Robert Noyce to come out here and buy a house than for him to live in an apartment in the heart of Philadelphia. And what has happened is the cost of living has gotten higher and higher. But as Silicon Valley has basically become an entrepreneurship machine, it's a whole environment set up to support entrepreneurs. The fact that it's very costly still hasn't overridden anything else, and people have been willing to come and come. We've been able to get the best and the brightest from all over the world to come here. I think the biggest threat to Silicon Valley is any sort of talk about limiting people's ability to come to the United States for education or to stay here afterwards. We need to be keeping our visa policies liberal and open, because this valley and this country have been built on the work of people who've come here from other places. And as long as Silicon Valley continues to be the place that the very best and brightest want to be, Silicon Valley will continue to be the innovative place it is now and has been historically.
And Regis McKenna, a final question for you, and this is about Steve Jobs, because I'm wondering what you see in terms of the impact of Apple, you know, losing its leader. And I know that when Steve Jobs was just starting out, he called Intel and asked, you know, who is in charge of marketing? And the answer was you. And he called you from Hawaii and said, you know, I've got problems with the iPhone 4. That was many years later. Is there any concern now that Steve Jobs, who was sort of this fountainhead of new ideas, that nobody has risen to replace him yet?
Well, I think there's a sort of myth of Apple and other companies with innovation is the product of one person. Steve was a great sponge. He absorbed a lot of ideas from people around him. And certainly you can't replace him. He was a unique personality and very dynamic, but everybody moves on. I mean, Intel has moved on to a whole new management team when people didn't think that, you know, Noyce and Moore and Grove could be replaced. Tim Cook came in right after Steve came back to Apple, and he implemented the logistics. And so I like to say is that logistics and support is really about 80% of innovation. So in effect, when you order an Apple product, it comes from China, and it's delivered to a store in another part of the world. or into your home in another part of the world, that whole system of delivery. Plus, I think that the same team that actually did a lot of the innovation, some of those innovations were there or in the process before Steve Jobs came, but they were never able to get up through the management structure. And I think that, you know, what Tim has done is to essentially create a more egalitarian type of top management structure in which ideas do flow. I think Apple's going to be okay for a while.
The innovation continues.
Oh, I think so, yes.
Regis McKenna, who, as he noted, has been a Silicon Valley marketer for 50 years, working with companies from Apple to Intel to Microsoft, and Leslie Berlin, a historian at Stanford and author of The Man Behind the Microchip. Thanks so much to both of you for joining us.
Welcome. Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks to you for joining us. Remember that you can check us out on the web at wgbh.org/innovationhub, where you can link to our free iTunes podcasts. And you can also follow us on Twitter at wgbhinnovate. I'm Kara Miller, and this is Innovation Hub.